I'll be meeting sometime in August with members of the education committee of this Sangha, of this community, plus other people who are involved in the leadership and organizing of the community, basically to talk about our relationship and where we might go from here. And as I was thinking about that meeting, it's really clear to me that that I come here for only one reason, really only one reason, and that is to help you in any way that I can to wake up from the dream of suffering. It's an amazing insight that the Buddha had, that there are causes for our discomfort, for our emotional discomfort in our lives, and those causes can be uprooted, and suffering can be eliminated. It's an amazing thought. And so it's really the only thing I want to do is to help to give you tools to free yourselves. And what that requires for all of us is that we pretty much have to change a whole bunch of habits, some of which are very deeply conditioned. We have a very deep habit, for example, not to be present for our experience, to be off somewhere, off in a story, not to be conscious, not to be aware or mindful. And we have also a very deep habit to be reactive to our experience, to want to hold on to what is pleasant even though we can't, and to resist what is unpleasant. So we're changing those attitudes. We're essentially, through practice, you know, the word that we use most often, through practice, we learn to purify our understanding of what is true and what isn't. We, through practice, we purify our intentions in our lives. Through practice, we purify our communications, learning to communicate, to speak and to write in ways that where we try to help others rather than to harm them, and purifying our actions, and purifying our work or our livelihood. So you see that this is a whole lot more than meditation. And we work to purify the effort that we make in our spiritual practice, and to purify mindfulness, this quality of awareness or presence, and to purify concentration. All of that involves practice. So that's one reason why when I came here to speak last month, I gave a talk about what I call the gnarliest subject in the Buddhist teaching, which is the most difficult for us to get our minds around, as it were, the fact that this is a selfless process, that there is no separate self here. And I spoke about that, spoke about why it's important for us to deconstruct the sense of separation that we have. And I suggested that we could practice in the intervening weeks between the last talk and this talk. I suggested that one of the ways that we can break down our self-obsession is actually to take an interest in others, to generate empathy. This is quite a buzzword these days because of a nomination for the Supreme Court, to practice empathy, compassion, loving kindness, to actually take an interest in other people's experience. And I knew when I made that suggestion that I was changing the rules of engagement between us, because I very rarely, over many years of coming here, very rarely have I offered some homework. And I thought, well, maybe they'll do it or maybe they won't. So I just want to ask, for those of you who were here last month and heard that suggestion, has anyone really actually made an effort? What I suggested is that we actually try to do this, that we actually keep a record of it and come back and share. Did anyone do that? Okay. Oh, very good. Yes. Would you like to?
I didn't remember until you said it that maybe it was because of your suggestion that I was doing it.
Oh, lovely.
I work in an emergency room, so I...
Please start with the microphone. It's okay. Oh, it's fine. You're doing great.
So I work in an emergency room, so they're both in crisis, physical and emotional. And especially with emotional crisis and anger, I really just try to focus compassion. And it sure worked for me. I think it worked for the patients, the family members. I definitely felt a more connected giving and a more calm response. I did feel like people in great states of anxiety came down.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's
wonderful. Wonderful. Sure. Anyone else? Anyone else to share that, any experience of the empathy of compassion?
Oh, I did. Okay.
Please.
I tried to turn it into a daily experience where each day I would take the time to just engage with somebody in a slowed down way. So it actually required me to leave the house, which was not every day. It didn't happen because I didn't leave the house every day. So, but when I did, it was, just even in the grocery store, just stopping and acknowledging the person checking you out and asking how they were, or, you know, just engaging with them in a different way. And it slowed everything down. And I guess it surprised people, because people you didn't normally... in a day, they probably don't have personal engagement in their job, so it's required them to like step back and think, oh, I'm going to respond to this person like they're a friend or something. So it was really nice. It was a treat to sort of do that to other people and have that experience myself. And it takes time, which is, you can't be in a hurry. So
you had a sense that it was reflected back to you?
Yes.
Beautiful. And that was your experience too?
Huh.
So I'm just curious from your experience, which leads to more happiness, feeling really separate from others or feeling connected? Instant karma.
Yeah. I felt pretty good about it.
That's That's beautiful, beautiful. Thank you, thanks. Anybody else want to share? From the last month or weeks? Since I asked you to do it, I did it myself, so I'd like to just share with you just a couple of things that have happened to me in the last month. Or however long it's been since I've been here last. And one of the things happened actually this morning. I live about 115 miles north of here in a really remote rural place. And so whenever I come to Albuquerque, it's straight to Costco. And I shop not only for myself, but also for another household in my community. For those of you who are familiar with Costco, when you leave, you have to show your receipt, and there's someone at the door that makes a mark. And so I came to the young woman who was going to check my receipt, and she said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm fine. I'm well. And how are you?" And she said, "Okay." And then she checked off my receipt. And then as I was passing her, she said to me, "I would be a whole lot better if everyone were as friendly as you are." And she did something which is really rare. She just very gently reached over and touched my shoulder. And it's just a very simple exchange, and yet how significant. You know, how much easier her work would be if everybody were friendly as they were going out the door. It's really simple, and yet it's actually quite profound as well. You know, the Dalai Lama famously said, "My religion is kindness." Just a couple of other experiences that have happened of just making an effort to extend empathy or compassion. A few weeks ago, I was driving from my home. I live in the Rio Grande Valley, about midway between Española and Taos, and I was driving up the canyon toward Taos to give a talk. And I came, for those of you who happen to know the Rio Grande Canyon, I came to County Line, and there were two people hitchhiking. Two people with two large packs and a large dog. And I stopped to pick them up. It was a young couple, a woman and a man, who I would guess were probably somewhere between 17 and 19 years old. And they had just been to the Rainbow Gathering, and they were on their way, they told me, either to West Virginia or New York or Florida. and they were nice people. They were very open, it was a very hot day. He was shirtless, and his pants had fallen so far down that they barely covered half of his butt. He told me that he had been on the road for 2 years. He'd been homeless for 2 years. And I just had some sense about what's going to happen to these people. They didn't strike me, actually, as sort of toughened people who are tough and have learned how to be resilient and to survive. Obviously, he has survived for 2 years. But they didn't seem to have that kind of toughness that would help them to survive on the road in the way that they were traveling. And I just thought, how is life going to turn out for them? And so it brought very much a kind of a parental feeling in me. I wanted to protect them, and I knew that I could only protect them for the few miles that I was driving them up to Taos. When I dropped them off in Taos, I said to them, "I'm probably going to earn something this evening. I want to share some of it with you." And I just gave them a little bit of money. They were amazed and very, very grateful. And what they didn't know is that I would have given my life for them. Now, what they didn't know is that I loved them as much as if they were my own biological children. That there's some way when the sense of self, of this sense of separation, as it becomes more attenuated, as there's less and less of that sense of self, and more the sense of connection, you actually enter the experience of others. The other day we have a meditation cave in my little community. I live in a little intentional community. And I had guests visiting from England, and I took them up to our meditation cave, and I opened the door, and there was a mouse crouched right in front of the door. It had been locked in, and it was in the very last stages of dying of thirst. It was barely alive. And so we had water with us, and we tried to get it to drink, and it drank a little bit, and it was pretty clear that the systems were shutting down, that it had no chance of surviving. There's some way in which I could feel its experience of dying of thirst. Does that make sense? And just one other experience of something that happened last week, just to share. I live in this community. We are about 7 or 8 households who share a little hidden valley that's right on the Rio Grande River. And there has been a difficulty in our end of the community, in the end that I live in. There are 3 households that share a little area, and there has been a big dispute between 2 of the households. And then just in recent weeks, there's been there's one person is having difficulty with the third household, and then they start having difficulty with me. And I decided, okay, it's my job. I mean, I talk about peace all the time. You know, making peace, it's really part of the Dharma. It's part of our teaching. It's really my task to try to bring peace into our little neighborhood. So I reached out to the neighbor that I was having some difficulty with. And I actually, last week, I happened to be, I experienced it for over 50 years now, experienced at times very severe depression. And I was so depressed last week that I could hardly put my shoes on. But I called my neighbor and I said, you know, can we just get together and talk? And we got together and talked and really worked things out with each other. You know, I just said, you know, I want to live in harmony with you side by side. And we really came to some really deep reconciliation. And then the next day, I invited all 3 of our households, there was a much more severe dispute happening with the other 2, to meet and to talk. And we, our 3 households, came to some very deep reconciliation. And some agreements that will make things easier in the future. And it was very clear to me, being severely ill, with for those of you who have experienced depression, you may have noticed that it's a very isolating illness. That when you're depressed, you tend to isolate. And so it was working really counter to that tendency toward isolation for me to reach out to first one neighbor and then to 2 neighbors. It meant working against the conditioning of the illness, and it actually was quite healing for me to connect in that way. So just some examples. And I think it's really important that we've shared these examples because for some strange reason, we tend, in our tradition, to think of spiritual practice as meditation practice. And the meditation practice is critically important. It's really important. But people can actually wake up and come to full awakening without ever doing a meditation sitting. If you can really make an effort moment by moment to be aware of your experience, to be present, aware of your experience, and if you can moment by moment cultivate kindness toward whatever your experience is, it isn't necessary to meditate. We feel that it's important, but it is not necessary. What is really necessary is awareness and love. And so if you have some sense, just from these examples that we have shared this evening, our practice is about how you relate to the checkout person in the supermarket. Our practice is how you relate to someone who needs $2 for to pay for parking their car. You know, our practice is about being in a highly stressful emergency room and making the effort to stay centered and kind, you know, which is not always easy. It's important. It's important because all of us have this extraordinary habit of self-obsession. Last time I spoke, I quoted the English writer Wei Wu Wei, who said that 99.9% of everything you say, everything you think, and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. And we do. And to begin to, obviously, it's really important for us to take care of ourselves. So this is not about being a martyr. It's not about being a doormat. It's not about not looking after our own needs. The women here particularly know about that conditioning. You know, take care of others and ignore your own needs. That is not the message here tonight. It's really about being kind to yourself. The Buddha said, you can look throughout the entire universe and find no being more worthy of love than yourself. That includes Buddhas. That includes Jesus. There is no one more worthy of love than you. And so, yes, we are loving to ourselves and take care of ourselves and in some way that feels wholesome, but that doesn't mean self-obsession. And just as we are as worthy of love as any other being in the universe, every single other being that we ever encounter is equally worthy of love. So to make that effort, the effort to see if it's possible actually to inhabit another person's experience. That's essentially what empathy is. If they're feeling fear, you feel the fear. If they're feeling angry, you feel the anger. If they're feeling love, you feel the love. If they're feeling calm and equanimous, you feel that. You feel the quality of their experience. What is it that keeps us from doing that? Yeah, the belief in self, the belief in separation, the belief that there's a me here and everything else is it, which is simply not true. It's like a coffin that we've created. It's a mind-created coffin that we're trapped in. And the mind can uncreate that coffin. It's just an amazing experience to when the sense of self is very attenuated, or when the sense of self actually disappears entirely, to walk through the world and know that the world is you. You know, to feel a river flowing through you. So yes, the sense of self keeps us from kicking out the door of the coffin and actually really connecting to others and taking an interest. I think it's also I think that there's also fear. It's a very, very deep sense, I think, that we all have and that we all have to work with, is that if we connect deeply to someone, we may be rejected by them, or for sure we're going to lose them. And that's true, actually. You know, we will lose them. Every relationship ends either in estrangement or death. There is no third choice. And so, is it possible to have the courage to open to another being and to connect deeply to that being with the certain knowledge of loss? It requires tremendous courage. Most of us won't do it. Or somehow, I don't know, when we're out in the public space, I guess we feel less vulnerable if we're closed. Otherwise, why would, you know, I was observing in Costco today, and then I actually got a tea at Whole Foods, and I sat at a table that was right by the checkout places, you know, at Whole Foods in Carlisle. And I was amazed at how many people didn't even look at the cashier. It was astonishing, you know, people looking down like that and using their card. And why would we do it? It's habit, but I think it's the habit of fear, actually. It's the habit of the illusion of self-protection. It's really an illusion because we're actually safer when we're connected. So, the belief that we're somehow separate, fear, and I think there's one other thing. I may be wrong about this. It's just kind of what's been coming to me recently, is that ever since human beings have had language, we have had stories, and I think we're all very interested in the stories. And there's this fascination for stories, the great mythological stories, all of the stories that we're exposed to. So it could be, you know, it could be the experience of Penelope and Odysseus and Telemachus in the Odyssey, or it could be interest in the soap opera, in Desperate Housewives, and whatever happens on daytime television. We want to know the stories. I'm just starting The Brothers Karamazov. It's quite a story. And my light summer reading after I finish a book called The Hemingses of Monticello, which is about the slave family that was Jefferson's family. That's also a wonderfully light reading. So we're fascinated by the stories, and I think that there are essentially, from what I can tell, there are two ways that we can, there are essentially two motivations that can keep us engaged with the stories. One is empathy. One is allowing ourselves deeply to enter the experience of others. So reading a great novel. Reading a great novel that was written, I don't know, 150 years ago, whatever it was, but feeling the living experience of these beings, or watching a soap opera. There's a sense in which we can inhabit other people's experience and we feel more connected. But I think there's also another possible motivation, and that is the sense that we carry either consciously or unconsciously, which is basically saying to people, you live out that experience so I don't have to. You do it by proxy. Marilyn Monroe, you do that for me. You know, it's Elvis Presley, you go through your horror so I don't have to do it. Kurt Cobain, you know, you do your story. So you live out my anguish for me. I think we project our shadow. Why is it that we're so interested in famous people? because on some level they're living out a drama that we don't have to experience. There's a kind of living by proxy, which is a separating thing. Am I being clear, or am I getting too abstract here? You know, so I think it's really interesting. Next time you engage in a story, and you're not going to be able to avoid it because the whole culture is made up of stories. The next time you go to a movie, you know, I saw Harry Potter last week when I was really depressed. It was good for me. The next time you go to a movie or turn on your television or open a book, open a magazine, the next time that you're engaged in someone's story, just ask yourself, why am I doing this? Am I doing it because it allows me to overcome the sense of separation and to feel really connected? And to inhabit someone else's experience? Or am I doing it because it, in a sense, it holds experience at arm's length? So there's a getting past the awful isolation of the sense of self. The Mother Teresa came to the West and she said to us, "You feel so much pity for the people of Calcutta, but actually you here in the West have a greater suffering, and it's the suffering of isolation. It's an isolation that we individualist Westerners carry with us unconsciously. It's the water we swim in. We don't even notice how disconnected we are." So overcoming in whatever ways that sense of separation, you know, all human beings who have the delusion of self experience that separation, but we in the West are particularly adept at it because of we have such a strong sense of the individual self. So we can do it, we can overcome it through empathy, loving kindness, compassion. We can also do it through wisdom. I'm just thinking that my understanding about what love is has really been evolving in recent years, and I feel now the Buddha defined loving kindness or true love as seeing the goodness in beings and wishing for their well-being and their happiness, and I more and more what I sense for myself. When I feel really connected and loving toward another human being, it was just an instant of connection. There was this beautiful connection with a young woman who was checking off the receipt at Costco. You know, it's like when she said to me, you know, "I would feel a lot better if everyone were as friendly as you are," she looked right in my eyes and touched my shoulder. You know, there was this moment, just an instant, and I just gave her a big smile because there was a line of people behind me. I just gave her a big smile and went on. But that experience of love, and there was a very deep experience of love actually in that instant of connection, I feel like what I'm more and more able to do is to reach past the weirdness of the personality, and we all have weird personalities. You know, do not consider yourself an exception. We are all really weird. You know, it's reaching past the weirdness of the personality, of all the quirks and the craziness and the neurosis, and just it's as if I can see this shining quality, this radiant quality. And so, in a sense, it's the radiant quality here touching the radiant quality there. You know, and as we become more and more adept at love, it can happen in more and more circumstances, even in difficult circumstances. You know, I felt such a deep sense of connection with my neighbor with whom I've been having some considerable difficulty over the last 2 or 3 weeks. Of reaching past our positions and simply seeing the goodness in each other and connecting. So we can do it through empathy, through compassion, of really seeing the suffering of beings and feeling the resonance of their suffering instead of turning away from it. But we also do it through wisdom. And actually, it's wisdom that actually frees us from this delusion on a deeper level, in a sense, than love or compassion or empathy. That as we observe reality, as we really pay attention to our experience, it becomes almost automatic. It's like an empirical scientific process. We just collect a whole bunch of information. I mentioned this when I was here last month. We collect a whole bunch of information by observing, using the mind as our instrument of observation, and then at some point, the reality of it, there's an insight into what is real. And what we come to see is, it's not self. You know, the physical sensation, the pain in my knee, is only a sensation. It's not me or mine. It becomes clear. And when the pain in my knee is no longer me or mine, I don't do such a trip over it. I don't struggle with it in the same way. Does that make sense? And actually, as we observe the thoughts, we are so identified with our thoughts. It is such a wonderful thing to realize, oh, it's just a thought. It's just words going through consciousness. It's only a thought. It's not me or mine. It's just words. And as we become less and less identified with those thoughts and realize that they are only thoughts, it's wonderfully liberating. And then the really difficult one, for me at least, the most difficult thing for me not to be identified with, is with emotions. Do you remember the last time you were really angry? Was that anger yours? Was it you, or was it yours? Yeah, it really felt like it, didn't it? And yet, it was only an emotion. It's only an energy moving through consciousness. It is not you. It isn't yours. It's only anger. It's enormously liberating to come to understand this. I'm finding it, you know, I just find it so interesting that I feel like I'm a walking experiment because there has been, over years of pretty dedicated practice, there has been a more and more reduced sense of self in this mind and heart. And yet, I also experienced two quite severe mental illnesses, emotional illnesses, post-traumatic stress disorder and depressive disorder. And I was deep in it last week, actually. And it's such an interesting thing because it's all hardwired in the brain. It's all hardwired in the neurological structure of the brain. I do not have control over it coming. But it's, you know, it's a delusive state. You know, when you get totally identified with despair and futility and anxiety and all the other things that make up depression. And I just find it really just so interesting to have this mind so deluded, and yet some part of it is not believing any of it. Does that make sense? There's some part of the psyche which just watches it and says, oh, that's really interesting. Whoa, look at that. But isn't lost in it. So some part of the psyche gets totally lost in it, totally identified with it, totally. My personal definition of mental illness is actually a profound identification with delusive states of consciousness. You know, it might be fear for paranoids, for depressives, it's despair. To be able to see the mind lost and then some aspect of the mind isn't lost. I just find that really interesting. So I just want to encourage us. You know, maybe I'll do an experiment again sometime. Maybe we could do the experiment again now. I'm just curious, you know. I'm just going to suggest once more, and there's no judgment in this, and there's no coercion, there's no nothing. But I'd like to suggest that we try once more, collectively, those who of you who intend to come back on whatever it is, the 13th of August or whatever, a couple of Thursdays from now, notice how many of your thoughts are about self. Notice how much of your concern is about self. Notice when you get into a defensive crouch over something. You know, essentially, when we have a strong sense of self, there's two basic mechanisms that click in when we have a strong sense of self. One is there's something here to defend, and the other is there's something here to gratify. And so that sense of self, the ignorance about reality, of believing that there's a separate self here, is what triggers the response that the Buddha said keeps us in suffering. It's grasping for what is pleasant, resisting what is unpleasant. Notice that. Notice that mechanism in yourself and see what does it take. You know, just as an experiment, this is a fascinating experiment, and there is nothing deeper that we can do than this. As an experiment, see if you can get past the sense of separation in order to connect. You know, and it can be connecting to a dying mouse. You know, it can be connecting to hitchhikers. It can be connecting to patients in an emergency room. It can be connecting to someone in a parking lot. It can be connecting to someone who's cashing you out at the supermarket. It's really wonderful. Sometimes I take on people as a project. You know, it's like someone is serving me, you know, a waiter or a waitress, or, you know, someone is serving me in some kind of capacity and they're totally shut down. I work them. You know, I keep being friendly and I keep asking them questions and I keep trying to connect to them, and sometimes I just can't get them out of their shell, but very often people will eventually soften and open up because everyone wants to be loved. We all want to be loved. Why do we withhold love from each other when we all want to be loved? I mean, it doesn't make sense. You know, if I love you, you love me, you know, we're getting what we need. If I withhold my love from you and you withhold your love from me, we're not getting what we need, and it's the most fundamental human need. So just to see, is it possible to reach out and to connect to the neighbor dog or to another human being or to those anguished people that you see on television? You know, is it possible to reach out and to connect to the Afghanis that you see on the news, for example? So anybody interested in doing this experiment with me? Oh, good. Okay. Great. So if you would, you know, come back a couple of weeks from now, and we'll have another chance to share and just see where we're going with it. And I will come prepared with to offer a Dharma talk if nobody wants to talk. Is that fair enough? Okay. Good. Okay. Yes, please. Yeah, Dwight.
A few years ago, one of your teachers, Joseph Goldstein, had a pretty amazing demonstration of selflessness. I think you said at the Taos Mountain Sangha. And we sat for maybe 15, 20 minutes just to relax. And then he said, think of something that you really like to do, like a hobby or a sport or a favorite recipe or something. Something that is uniquely yours. And so so we all sat there and kind of pondered that for a while. And then he had us kind of do that again. And so we kind of came up with this short list of things that were uniquely ours. And then he said, after a while, now imagine those things belong to the person sitting next to you. And so we all kind of mentally did that. And then he said, now re-examine those things that are uniquely yours. And it was like, they just went, poof.
Beautiful. Wow, what a beautiful example. Thank you. That might be an interesting exercise.
Yeah. I like it.
Any, please.
This is maybe a little off the track, but thank you. Christine and I go to lectures at Oasis, and we had a lecture today. I keep losing it. There it is.
Yeah.
Okay, we had a lecture today from this professor at UNM, and it was on peacemakers. And, of course, in his mind, the only peacemaker, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, that he said was like 100% nonviolent was Gandhi. But in looking over this list of peacemakers, he said the largest number of people that were on that list came from the smallest religious group on earth, the Buddhists. And of course, we're sitting back there grinning. But he did mention, well, he had Gandhi and he had Buddha Gosa and Aung San Suu Kyi and a Muslim whose name I can't remember. But it was a very interesting group of people, and it kind of made me feel good. Oh, because one of the things that had to be part of it was that they strove for peace even at risk of their own lives. That was kind of a qualifying factor. And it was just, it was an extremely interesting talk. I enjoyed it very much, and I wanted to share that.
And that's the Dalai Lama was on there as well.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Uh-huh. Is he a Buddhist?
But he said he was not 100%.
Right.
Against violence.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King.
Huh? Wow. Any other comments or questions, please?
This is a little bold for me to say this in the middle of the group, but I'm going to say it anyway. Maybe I should just say I'm scared to ask. So you talk about empathy, and you talk about finding that place where we can connect.
Right.
And it's a big focus in my life because I have a disability and my life is very slow and very quiet. So I'm constantly working with isolation and pulling in and taking care of myself and also reaching out and designing a new world, which is what I've been doing the last 3 years. And so what you're saying is kind of like my 24-hour life. And I clearly don't walk on water, but part of my nature is empathy. That's just part of who I am. I was born to be a caretaker, so that's been a lot of my role. I'm really aware of opening doors for people. I'm really aware of looking people in the eye. That's just kind of who I am. And I'm not perfect, I'm not always kind. Trust me, I'm not saying that. So you say all these things, Eric, and then there's that part of me that says, oh, yeah, but I'm really struggling in my practice with where I'm reaching out to people and where I'm pulling back in and isolating and feeling very self-centered to take care of myself. There's that push-pull. And that's just my practice right now, so it's just really beautiful to be here.
Yeah.
To hear you, and you know that you picked up the hitchhiker, and that you were trying to feed the mouse water. I mean, I've cried about 5 times tonight because I know what it means to feel other people's experience, because that's just my makeup. That's the world I've lived in,
I'm glad to say now I'm medicated enough that I don't feel it as intensely, just as run my universe, which is very nice. I have insulation around me now with the remedy, but it's just my nature. I mean, I walk in the room and I can feel the mood of people. I can tune in very easily, and I wonder about that place, right? You go into your depression, and you go into your depression, and you get on your bed, and that's it. But in your mind, you've got to meet the neighbor. You've got to deal with being in your community and being in this world. So you've got to make that time, and you've got to put your shoes on.
Yeah.
There is no choice. And I love that story, and in my world, I have a bit more choice. I don't live in an intentional community. But I do live in a compound where there's a friend who right now doesn't walk. She's learning how to walk again. And I've put a lot out to her the last 6 months, and I'm starting to pull back, and I've gone through 6 months of, like, all kinds of stuff around. Where do I stop? Where do I help? Where do I love? Where do I pull in?
If I may, I just want to make one comment, just to reflect back to you. My sense is that it's not necessarily selfish at all for us to pull back and take care of ourselves. You know, we can. It's really noticing the quality of consciousness by which we pull back and take care of ourselves. So there can be a sense of aversion and wanting to get away from the world. That's one thing. But that sense of actually needing to nurture ourselves or heal ourselves is actually an act of empathy and love toward ourselves. So I just want to say, in my mind, it isn't necessarily in any way selfish for us to care for ourselves. And that's something that I've learned because I do juggle two pretty severe emotional illnesses. In order to do the work that I do, I have to spend a whole lot of time caring for myself. You know, and I really understand that self-nurturing that I do makes it possible, say, for me to come here and to share with you this evening. So it could be an entirely wholesome thing for us to pull back and care for ourselves.
I guess it's that other piece too, Erica. My tolerance of people in the world in the last 3 years has been like this. Mm-hmm. And it's growing. It's more like mm-hmm. this now. But never in my life have I just been like, oh, I just cannot deal with this, or this, or this. And that's not been my nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that part of me that, wow, it's just like, there's a lot of things I don't like. And I don't tolerate and I stay away. People I've divorced, I unplug the phone more, I don't turn the TV on hardly at all. That feels intensely selfish. That's what I'm looking at, I think, also.
Right, and you know, I just, there's a way in which we protect ourselves in a wholesome way, and there's a way in which we protect ourselves in an unwholesome way, and only we can distinguish that. So not turning on the television can be an act of rejection, or it can be actually an act of nurturing. And only you can tell that. Nobody can tell it for you. Just final comment, please. Right. Yeah, I think that if I may share, it's just a way of avoiding pain. on some level. I find it very, very painful to live next to someone where our houses are actually quite close together, and for a while we were coming out and my neighbor would turn her head away when I walked into my yard. Way too painful. And so I was willing to do anything I could in order to have the happiness of harmony. You know, that's what it was. It wasn't coming from the head, it was coming from the heart.
How do you get from despair and agility to taking care of things?
Yeah, I know it's just that if there's a habit of loving kindness and compassion, and it's a very deep habit, it will assert itself even in the midst of psychotic depression. You know, that's all I can say. Thanks so much. Thank you.